evening, and welcome to the United Lodge of Philadelphia, United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. The United Lodge of Theosophists is a different type of organization in that there are no offices, no constitution, and no bylaws. Its existence is sustained by devotion to the teachings of the founders of the modern theosophical movement, H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. All are invited to join in its efforts to spread, broadcast the message of those teachings to the world. The only requirement being that all who come forward share similar aims and purpose and make themselves, by study, better able to teach others. United Lodge of Theosophists, founded in 1909, and has lodges throughout the world, offering regularly scheduled lectures and study classes that are free and open to the public. In accordance with that common aim, the ULT here in Philadelphia holds two weekly meetings. On Wednesday, the library opens at 5:30 and stays open until 7:30. And the Wednesday meeting follows starting at 7:45 and continuing until 9 p.m. We are currently studying The Ocean of Theosophy by Mr. Judge. The doors open for the Sunday meetings at 10:30 a.m. and the meetings start promptly at 11 and continue until 12 noon. Next Sunday's topic will be What Happens After Death. The book table and reception area through the door behind you offers straight line theosophical material at the cost of printing and shipping. We realize no profits from this material. Also, we'd like to draw your attention to our updated website, ultphiladelphia.org, where you can download podcasts of our meetings and keep abreast of the activities of this lodge. All work here is performed on a voluntary basis of time, effort, and money, and all contributions are greatly appreciated. This evening's topic is the Sermon on the Mount. Growing up in a Christian society, you really think that the Sermon on the Mount is so familiar. You've heard about it so much. You've heard pieces of it. They've talked about it in the churches. Possibly your parents at one time or another broached it with you. And you feel familiar with it. You feel as though, well, yeah, I got an idea. I know what this is. I think I know what it is. But really, it is very different when study closely than our casual observation of it reveals to us. One of the most peculiar things, and not peculiar, but one of the things that is really kind of gets you, it's truly not per se a Christian doctrine per se. It is echoes from previous religions and philosophies, and its contributors are many, and from all over the world. And the other thing about it, when taken without the proper understanding, it appears to be almost undoable. How could you possibly do these things? I mean, it's asking more from you than how could you do these? It would go against your very nature to try and put this into practice. But that's some parts of the world that's not true. The Sermon on the Mount was given to Jesus' disciples. It wasn't given to the general public. It was given to those who desired spiritual excellence. those who had cast their whole lot into that idea to be as godlike as possible. So there was another teaching that Jesus gave to just the regular people, but to his disciples, he gave this teaching. And when you start looking at it and you start comparing it with other, you know, documents, the Gita and Patanjali's and different, you see why he gave this just to his disciples. You have to be prepared to see and understand what is being told to you, what is being taught to you. One of the reasons that it seemed, in fact, one of the teachings that I remember, and please just forgive me this aside, I think it'd be worth it. During the 60s, in this nation, in the black community, there were two forces. It was Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And I can remember a speech given by Malcolm X, who was an excellent speech giver, and he said that King, this idea that people can strike you and you don't fight back or you don't run, was absolutely against the laws of nature. That everything that drew breath when attacked would either fight or flight. And I thought to myself at that time, being young, not being, you know, really exposed to a lot of ideas, I said, well, you know, that makes sense, what he's saying. But King was actually moving in a different direction. The idea of turning the other cheek when someone hits you, which is actually around Matthew's 5:39. What it is, instinctively, on an animal level, you do fight or flight. But the people that he is speaking to are seeking to overcome that animal level. They have been exposed to a different idea than what most of us are exposed to. And it's in the Bible, and it's also in the Gita and probably quite a few other places. In the Bible, it says in 1 Corinthians 3:16, "Know ye not that ye are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you?" And then you go to the Gita, and the Gita says, "I myself never was not, nor thou, nor all the princes of the earth, nor shall we ever hereafter cease to be." So you are dealing with the animal who's dealing on instincts and dealing in just this world of senses. But who this is addressed to is that principle inside the body that is dealing with eternity, not the moment, but with eternity, which has no beginning and no ending. And in that knowledge, you know that you cannot truly be hurt. The body you might destroy the body, but that principle is still there. It fears not any pain or destruction or attack on the body. So you see that these are addressed to people who are thinking differently than the majority of people think. That is one of the requirements. These are disciples. These are people who are truly about the eternal part of man. They have that already. They are prepared. They are going forth under that banner. So that's the other thing that makes it so difficult for us for most people to get a grip on. This evening, we won't have time to really deal with all of this in depth. What we will do, more than likely, we'll probably get to the Beatitudes and some of the other parts, but hopefully it will strike a chord and make us see how worthwhile it is to undertake the study of this document, this enlightening document, this practical document in our lives, to make it practical, to work on that.
Well, Jesus was an echo of Buddha, who lived 500 years before. And although there was a teacher on the scene, there's a lot of mystery around who Jesus actually was. But there was a teacher, and there was a teacher and the teachings. And that's the important thing to concentrate on. So Buddhism and Christianity, they share many of the same core fundamental ideas. And one is that we are exhorted to strive for the ideal. We are always told to strive for the ideal. We may fall short. We will fall short. It's a process of trial and error. And that is really the only way that we learn. The Buddha tends to put things kind of in a negative way, but that is because we are assumed that we need to really sin and go through the process first before we have some sense of remorse and want to change. So ideals that are outlined within the Sermon on the Mount, they point the audience to that ideal. A life must be lived ideally is a life it's almost impossible to master in the modern secular world, or so we think. We think that because we have many distractions, many choices, much materialism, but yet the Sermon on the Mount and the Dhammapada, which are the sayings and aphorisms of the Buddha, they really put things in perspective for those that want to be in the world but not of the world. So Jesus was trying to get across that adherence as close to the ideal as possible is the best route to take. Jesus stated, "But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who mistreat you." And this seems to fly in the face of reason, because the lower personal man, which is really the animal man, the animal soul, full of passions and desires, is not in tune with the higher aspirations when we're wounded. We're like wounded animals in a sense. When we feel wounded, we want to either justify, retaliate, attack. We want some sort of revenge often, or we might not consciously want revenge, but in a sense, we do. Now, Jesus says that the ultimate hope is to have human beings live according to the ideal and in exchange for non-temporal benefits. In other words, non-temporal, not of this world. Jesus further explains that the Christian ideal outlined on the Sermon on the Mount states to love your enemy, to do good to them, and to lend to them without expecting anything back. And lending to one's enemies may seem like, if someone is in need, to lend it to them without even expecting any return, any interest on the principal, let alone the principal itself, it runs counter to everything that we're taught, but it's really an antidote to materialism. If we feel that this person, regardless of whether they're friend or enemy, comes to me in a state of need and I help them out, if we really have faith in the law, we can realize that, well, it will be taken care of. It's not like the lilies of the field. They don't care. You know, they're nurtured, they grow, the rain comes, the sunshine comes. But it's an antidote to materialism when you're thinking along these lines. Jesus further outlined the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus goes on to explain that living by the ideal on the Sermon on the Mount is living a life free from worries. So often we're full of worry and anxiety, but if we can live by the Sermon on the Mount, we really are above worries and above anxieties. He says, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, or what you will wear. The ideal that Jesus preaches would prefer us to concern ourselves with things of greater and more meaningful importance. Now, in the Buddhist Dhammapada are also contained thoughts on how human beings should live the ideal life. And in a sense, it's really simpler. It puts things in a... Just this one statement says so much. Meditate. Live purely, be quiet, do your work with mastery. So this statement of living the ideal life is actually simpler and more direct. But obtaining mastery is no small task. And here we wanted to pose a thought between the two, the Sermon on the Mount and the Dhammapada, that there was a 500-year difference, and one was in the East and the other was in the West. And we were wondering if it could be that after 500 years elapsed, that the world needed more detailed instructions due to the advance of the Kali Yuga, or the Dark Age, or the Iron Age that we're in now, and also due to the influence of the Roman Empire in the West. So just something for your consideration. We don't have the answer, it's merely a question. So then we need to also ask the question, can a man, through living purely and quietly, accomplish the ideal life and hence achieve his state of mastery? Living purely and quietly, can we accomplish things without a show, without credit, without expecting any return? The Dhammapada goes on to say, alas for the man who raises his hand against another, and even more for him who returns the blow. So this is not strictly a Buddhist teaching, of course. The non-retaliation on the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus said, if someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. So not only these two messages, say that violence is not an option, but rather these messages are taken a bit further and say that violence should not be used as a means of revenge either. And by not taking revenge or even wanting it, we can subvert the personality and elevate the individuality or the higher self. In closing, the ideals that are outlined in both the Sermon on the Mount and the Dhammapada requires one to put aside things that most people see as being fundamental beliefs of the personal survival or personal personal betterment in this competitive world. So the floor is open for questions, comments, corrections.
If we really look at the Beatitudes and consider karma, they're just a statement of what happens or what is the result if you do this, you will get this, except for the one about turn the other cheek. It doesn't explain what that result would be karmically. But we think it would be a disconnection with whatever you did in the past that caused you to be hit then anyway.
That's addressed in a couple of the Beatitudes, the one on mercy.
Blessed are the merciful, for they shall see mercy.
Right. And the idea of that is striving to achieve your godhood, because what happens is, and there's a Indian story about this, I believe it's Indian, and they say that the difference between man and God is if you wrong a man, he will forget all of the good that you ever did for him. All he will remember is that you wronged him. But if you wrong God, he still retains the good that you did. Therefore, to forgive another's wrongs makes you godlike. But, and it goes into a lot more detail in that, but that's the general idea. Yes, ma'am.
For the first time, hearing those expressions, turn the other cheek and lend when in need, even to an enemy, we realize that's what it is. It is the resolution of that ancient karmic tie, whatever it might be. If we've gotten hit, if we've received a blow, karma's telling us it's a return from an action we put forward. Let's postulate that. Or if we strike out, the other has been involved in some experience in some lifetime. If we strike back, we are continuing the karmic struggle. By turning the other cheek, or in any act of forgiveness or sympathy or generosity, we have changed the vibration of the relationship and perhaps, hopefully, resolved it. And the other would be tremendously shocked at that moment.
The other thing, too, is that it... What causes us to fight back or to fight or flight? Fear. To turn the other cheek means you have subdued fear, which is one of man's biggest obstacles to get around. Yes, ma'am.
Well, we think in addition to fear, it's a sense of having been wronged. This isn't fair, what's happening to me. So once you have an understanding of karma, you put that all aside and say, well, okay, I don't see how it's fair, but law is in operation everywhere in the universe. So if I plant carrots, I know it's going to be carrots that come. So I planted this ugliness. There is a problem with turn the other cheek, though. You can do it at the initial event. But what if the person keeps persecuting you? You do have the right at some point to prevent or defend or get out of the reach of that individual.
You're right on the money. You'll get an argument from me on that. most of these things, you know, actually, I don't want to pick any particular one because they are so interwoven together that when you address one, you usually end up addressing more than one. But the thing that you find that is so consistent with them is that they all are exhorting you to raise yourself up from the sensual level, from the idea of the senses being your world. It actually helps to lift you into your higher being, into the higher triad of your existence. Everything that it says, it points to that. It doesn't point to what is usual, which is the, like I say, the animal or the instinct, essential parts of our being. Yes, ma'am.
Could we hear some of them? It's been a long time since we've heard them.
I thought you'd never ask. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This one, then this is the first one. It's mind blowing, because it also has a correspondent in the Gita, but it says not. What do they mean when they say poor in spirit? Yes.
Well, we hear it as even those ignorant of the spirit within still merit the rewards of that spirit being there. Something like that.
Yes, and also humble. Those who are humble. You know, I mean, really, it's difficult to find humble people in today's world. Even, you know, because those who have accomplished a lot, they, you know, or those who haven't accomplished, they're proud of what they didn't accomplish. They're those who are really good looking and those who aren't good looking. You know, I mean, it's hard to find humble people. And that's what this is saying, to be humble, not just humble to one another, but humble in the idea you cannot fill a vessel that is already filled. This, you become the vessel that is going to be filled with the spirit. You are humble. You really understand what there is that you are seeking. And you have emptied yourself of all your preconception. You have emptied yourself of all the pride and your degrees. You've emptied yourself of all of the, you know, your accomplishments, because you are awaiting something greater. That's why you are considered the poor in spirit, according to this. Yes, yes, ma'am.
With the idea of fight of life, that in terms of not fighting back, but relying on the law for justice. And under those circumstances, one would not want to retaliate. But another question I have, how can we know when we do evil to someone else that they deserve it? How do we know that it's not coming from ourselves for some reason or another? How can we choose to be an agent consciously? Some people are unconscious agents, but how can we constantly, consciously choose to be an agent to someone else and say that they deserve it? I don't understand that.
It's a very good question, but I would say, why do evil to anyone? And that's what is consistent throughout the Beatitudes, is that you don't do you don't do evil to anyone. As a matter of fact, there was one that was really, and I don't think this is the Beatitudes, though.
Well, you mean if a man takes your cloak, give him your cape?
Well, it wasn't, that's one of the things about having really good notes, you get too many of them. Do you want to jump in on this?
Where are we? Well, we should really try to get over that desire to retaliate.
That wasn't the question.
Okay.
The question was,
oh, here we are.
Why would the person who persecutes continue to persecute maybe three decades and say that it's someone else's karma? My question is, how can we consciously do evil and say that it's someone else's karma? How do we know that? How do we know that it's not something coming from a lower part of our nature that wants to be satisfied?
This might throw some light on it. This is Matthew 5:45, 5:46. For if you love those who love you, and reward, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans do the same? And if you salute your brothers only, what do you more than others? Do not even the publicans? Be you therefore perfect, just as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. Yes, it does. Listen to the second. This is from a Lao Tzu. Treat those who are good with goodness, and also treat those who are not good with goodness. Thus, goodness is attained. Be honest to those who are honest, and be also honest to those who are not honest. Thus, honesty is attained.
That's not the answer that I'm searching for.
I'm sorry?
You see, and I've heard this for the last 40 years, it seems as though emphasis is always placed on, let's say, the criminal, and that is placed on the victim, and always the criminal is able to go free. But it seems to me that there should be some kind of teaching that would teach us not to be criminals and then say that we're doing it because someone else deserved it. It just seems to me that that would be a sense of fairness. For example, we could forgive a person for 100 years, but that may not help the person. So it seems to me there should be some teaching against criminality.
Well, there's the United States, we have more criminals in jail than any country in the world. But does that make us a better country? I mean, there is a lot of retaliation against criminals. There certainly is. As a matter of fact, there's this three-strike law where you could steal a videotape. You could have two felonies and steal a videotape and do life in jail. There's people actually serving time. So we don't really understand.
I'm not trying to say that we should do evil to someone who's evil. I'm not saying that we're trying to do that. But it seems to me a person who breaks the laws of nature under any circumstances should be told.
How can the victim help the criminal? Is that what you're saying?
No, that is not at all what I'm saying.
No.
You see, all of the teachings that I hear is designed to tell the victim how to overcome the karma, okay, which is very good.
Okay.
But it seems to me that the person who commits
the person
who constitutes himself an angel needs help as well.
That's true.
That's really all.
Well, the perpetrator is still learning. That's the hard part. The perpetrator is still learning through maybe lives of doing this until they reach a turning point.
So you don't have to say anything about
it. Well,
it's just the philosophy is full of teachings about no matter what is done, don't do anything back. Don't judge others. Don't set out to harm anyone. We are supposed to be harmless. If someone is setting out to do criminal things to other people, pitiful them, because they will get the results. We may not see it immediately, but they will get it. So we shouldn't think that theosophy just directs itself to the victims, telling them how to behave.
Plus, at the core of this, there's only one. We are both the victim and the perpetrator. We are not different. We are the same. We're the same. When we individualize is where we get into trouble. And those of us who understand that, the burden is on us to exemplify what that means. That's why it is given to you not to strike back. You know better. You have studied. This person on the street, God knows what drives them, what forces drive them. But the forces that you seek to put in control have already warned you, have already guided you, have always given you the blessing of wisdom that you're not to strike back. You only make it worse. Yes, ma'am.
We were just thinking ignorance of the law is no excuse. The unwitting, shall we call them, agent of whatever this action is, they don't set out to do it, but it becomes the struggle for them. The fact that they didn't set out to do it doesn't relieve any of the responsibility of whatever their action will be. So we were thinking in
Exactly. Well, and as one of the other, and I'm not sure if the. Go ahead.
Well, we either believe in karma or we don't believe in it. And karma is, very simply, an undeviating and unerring tendency in the universe to restore equilibrium, and it operates incessantly. So it may be operating on us incessantly in a way that we don't enjoy, that's very heavy and very onerous and is quite a burden. But if we think, you know, it also says, one of the aphorisms, that it's absolutely fruitless to try to seek out the root causes of karma, because after 18 million years living in life after life after life, we can't trace it. It's absolutely fruitless. We just have to deal with what's in front of us, and it's hard for every one of us. The person who's the perpetrator may be suffering in other ways, maybe even worse.
Well, and I'd like to add to that. Forgive my transgressions as I forgive those who transgress against me. All of these things, to me, it seems, point to the same thing. We are one. We can't get away from one another. We are one. The only thing that we can do, the only power that we have, is to uplift all. We have no other power. We cannot get away from ourselves. We are all here together. We're in this little ship together. Unless we lift the standard of behavior towards excellence, there's nothing else we can do.
The statement that you just made, people misinterpret it. It's, forgive me exactly as I forgive everybody else. It's another statement of karma. So you're in a situation and somebody won't forgive you, you can realize, I better work on that myself.
Exactly.
Because there's some problem with me.
Exactly. And all of the things that you read here, as you examine them more closely, you see that there is a web of entanglement in which we are all bound. We cannot by ourselves extricate ourselves from the consequences and the actions. We only can make the actions of a higher level so that the consequences become more bearable to us. But we can't get out of it. We are together. We are one. We are here.
Well, there is a way to get out of it.
Interesting.
In the Dhammapada, it said, desiring nothing, doubting nothing, beyond judgment and sorrow, and the pleasure of the senses, he has moved beyond time. He is pure and free. It is possible. It's just very, very difficult. Idea of scapegoat. It's very common in today's society because nobody that's in power wants to take the fall. We'll say that much. It's not a good thing. It's not desirable or practical or spiritual to try to scapegoat another, and it's very dangerous.
Second,
there, you've had your hand up. Yes.
focused on a person, there's a mixture of karma going on from both of them. And the scapegoat, as was said, is, especially if it's in a family, they're in that family for a reason, just as much as the family is intertwined with them. So it is, it's totally under law from both sides.
Well, that is absolutely true. If we could clear up the Gita thing. In the Gita, well, it's in the Gita notes, Mr. Judge explains that there was an ancient system of sacrifice where they literally would take a goat, or perhaps even another creature, and everybody would, but don't ask how, everybody would get rid of their sins, and they would then be in this creature, and then the creature would be sacrificed. So scapegoat meant sacrifice goat for the good of the community. So we shouldn't use that word about
it's,
any
it's,
of this other
it
stuff.
It sounds like the doctrine of vicarious atonement.
Sin eaters, yes.
Right. There's this, right, there's that phenomenon of the sin eater, but that's vicarious atonement, and that's ignorance of the law is no excuse. We still have to meet our karma, our duty.
And not only that, mistreating that poor animal.
That's true.
Is added to it.
That's true.
Yes, ma'am.
Could we hear some others?
Oh, but of course. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God.
I'm sorry, what was the last one?
The pure in heart.
Pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. Yes, ma'am.
So it sounds like specific instructions that could be together drawn as the golden rule. In a sense, the blessing comes from this. Here's the equal to this, in a sense.
And the rewards are very specific, too, which... Like I say, this is a real study. It's not a casual glance. But if you look into what these rewards are, the kingdom of heaven, or comforted on this particular one, blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. We all think that we understand what mourning is because we lose our jobs and we mourn. A friend of ours passes, we mourn. Bad luck befalls us, we mourn. But who they're talking about is that individual who mourns that missed opportunity to become united with the higher self. That's who really who they are speaking to. Not to those of us who lose our wealth or who lose our friends or who lose our homes. It is talking the things on this sensual level. But that opportunity to draw closer to the highest of our existence. Yes, ma'am.
We were thinking in terms of all of the things that you read, and they sound good to me, but in theosophy, we have taught ourselves to not to place emphasis on any reward for what we may be doing. And we are wondering if it's possible to perform
it,
special duty for the good of all, a mission or whatever, however you want to pronounce that.
If we do have the strength and it comes to us, then it is our individual karma.
But I don't mean karma in terms of cause and effect, but karma in terms as the law can use you to carry out a certain mission for the good of all.
We should be honored and thrilled that we have that much strength and that much power.
But you see, you would lose your humility if you would put in a special emphasis on it. From what I have read, you don't become personal about any of these things. They are done impersonally. We could never personally love someone who persecutes us. But when we think of that someone as a part of ourselves, then we can love them on a higher level and have a greater interest and a greater reason.
But we shouldn't be thinking about those who persecute us too much, because we're giving them more power every time we think about it. So I would like to read this. But I tell you, this is from from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, but I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So the more we think about our persecutors... Well,
I don't know. We came up differently under different governments and so forth and so on. And my background is that there have been many of my people who have been hung on the trees and so forth and so on. We don't even want to get into that. But it seemed some of that was to scare the whole community rather than just the one person.
Well, again, we have to try to move away from concentrating on the perpetrator, because it will just drive us insane.
Yes, sir.
We think one of the major teachings of all of these wise ones, we've been studying a bunch of them, the last two, the Judaism and Islam, all have that same teaching. Care what you do, how you think, how you feel, how you act. What comes to you, well, yes, study it, learn from it, but recognize it as something that can only be considered a debt. But your focus is on how am I treating life and everyone I deal with.
That's the thing that the most amazing, the kernel of all of this is that you are striving to move to a place where you become selfless, where you don't have these individual nuggets caught into your, you know, you get beyond the personality. You're no longer a woman, you're no longer white, you're no longer black, you're no longer old, you're no longer young. That part of you that defies all of that is what you're striving to reach to. And it is constantly telling you in one form or another to drop these personal parts of you. The word person, and I know everyone here knows, the word personality comes from persona, which means mask. Let down your mask. Be at one with the best part of you. You will meet others of the same in that particular realm. And that's what the whole thing is about. And I mean, it's, we hold these things like Marley holding the chains, you know? We just won't let them go.
It's difficult to let things go when they happen to you every day. You know, it's difficult to feel well every day when you are sick in some form of your body.
But that's the main thing they tell you. It is not easy. It is not easy.
Yeah.
It is extremely difficult.
Yeah, it is.
But if it wasn't difficult, everybody would do it. So we keep striving. Yes, ma'am.
And we think that the sermon was given to the select few who put themselves, as was said in the beginning, in line to be taught and were ready to subjugate themselves to whatever the teachings would be. And we think the biggest message in all of those is there will be suffering. There are races.
far as the horrible things, we are fortunate because we live in a land where it isn't as great as it is in some other lands. There are other spots on the planet where anyone who wanted to do a draw up the specifications for hell could go there and learn a few tricks. There are parts on the earth that are like that. We are not all moving at the same rate in space and time. We are moving at different rates and different levels, but we are all in this together. Yes, ma'am.
And speaking of Buddha, I mean, he has his whole, there's so much of his teachings have to do with suffering. And he says that people will suffer, but then we have the choice as to how we respond to that suffering.
Well, we're also told, woe to him who lives without suffering.
Exactly.
It's the only way we learn. We don't learn from joy, unfortunately.
And incidentally, too, you know, I started the meeting speaking of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And it's interesting. They were both men who came up about the same time, witnessed the same thing. Yet one was able to say, let's get beyond this. Let's see what we can do to uplift everyone. And the other one is saying, and rightfully so, protect yourself. This is hostile. This is, you know, we're trapped in a hostile area. But the point is, these are two men from the same back, from basically almost a common background, seeing things differently. And it's funny how things change, because when I was young, Malcolm X was the man as far as I was concerned. But as I got older and could study, Martin Luther King is an example to everyone. Yes, ma'am.
He said that I wanted to say that Malcolm X did go to India for a while, and he changed his opinion about living. And it seems as though he came back to this country, and because he had become the kind of person that Martin Luther King is, he was killed.
He didn't make that change in the later part of his life. Yes, ma'am.
We had occasion to talk with an older black woman who's an educator here in Philadelphia, and she was a friend of Martin Luther King's. And when he started his movement, she jumped in and said, I want to be part of it. And he said, you can't, because you're full of anger. You hate bigots, and you cannot have hate and anger and be part of a movement of peace. So support us in any way you can and work on your anger.
Exactly. And you know, that's a... people say, I have righteous anger. There's no such thing. Because once you introduce anger, it's anger. You can't have righteous anger. It is a destructive force. It's like carrying acid in your bare hands. Nothing good will come of that. So it's not righteous anger that you're feeling. You're feeling something destructive, something that is aiming against your own betterment. This is, as we open this meeting, I honestly, and I'm saying this, and it's just us here, it's almost like family. In fact, it is family. Mm-hmm. One of the really fun things about studying for these is you look at subjects that you think you know, and you get two or three pages into it, and the first thing out of your mouth or in pops into your head is, I didn't know that. And it's always fun. I really feel like I should pay a cover charge to get these classes. It's really that much. It's really that eye-opening. I wish I could have given you, because I did a lot of reading on this, I wish I could have transmitted to you the benefits of the things that I learned in this shorter time. Unfortunately, I couldn't. But hopefully, we might have this again, and I'll be able to be better prepared and more able to share with you that which I have come across.
Well, each of us has to strive. These teachings, we're told, were given to us, they were impressed on us, They're already part of us. They're in our inner nature that high adepts and initiates and really gods walked the earth and taught us. And we listened to them, but then they said, okay, now you're on your own. And we had to stray. We had to sin. We have to suffer. They learned that way too. That's what many of us don't realize. They didn't earn their high estate. They had to earn their high estate. Their high estate wasn't just given to them. One thing I would like to say, one more thing from the Dhammapada, that he who can really achieve and live the ideal life, he is calm. In him, the seed of renewing life has been consumed. He has conquered all the inner worlds. It's said that it's much harder to conquer ourselves than to conquer the world. I mean, we think of what Alexander the Great did in conquering worlds, in conquering the known world at the time. It's much harder to conquer the inner worlds. So the whole thing is, once we have done this, we can form a nucleus of universal brotherhood in which the fundamental smooth running of a society can allow us to live in harmony with one another.
We've got 1 minute. I just want to run this, say this a little bit. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. This says to the aspirant, seek fulfillment in life, in a life of self-surrender to the higher triad. When one does away with the ideas of me and mine and loses himself in the all, he loses nothing, he gains all. History has shown us that those who seek to conquer the earth through force of arms are doomed to failure. The miser is chained to the gold and it is in reality a slave to gold. The all of all is the true owner of all. On this level, we are only caretakers until we surrender and become one with that all, thus inheriting the earth. Don't forget, Sunday, we're going to have states after death. And we look forward to seeing everyone there. And this meeting is adjourned. Have a great evening.